Narcissism and envy, fear and panic. What do these pairs have to do with each other? And what can they tell us about human behavior? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, we listen back to two conversations from earlier this year. In the first half, host Ben Kiefer learns about new research on where fear originates in the brain. He talks with neuroscientist and psychiatrist Dr. John Wemmy of the University of Iowa. And in the second half hour, research at Iowa State University looks at how the relationship between narcissism and envy may provide some insight into sudden outbursts of aggressive behavior. That's all coming up right after the news.
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. This half hour is all about narcissism. I was thinking if you could find one news soundbite from the past few years that sums up narcissism, narcissistic behavior, what would it be? Well, here's what came to mind for me. You may remember it back in the news back in 2009. Country music star Taylor Swift is accepting her award for Best Female Video, the MTV Awards. She's so thrilled, glowing under the spotlight with thunderous applause when up onto the stage bounds rapper Kanye West to interrupt her acceptance speech.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm going to let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time. One of the best videos of all time.
Well, narcissism itself has stepped into the spotlight of science news recently. Understanding the relationship between narcissism and envy may provide some insight into sudden outbursts of aggressive behavior. Narcissism has long been associated with envy in the field of psychology, but an Iowa State study now provides new evidence about that connection. Joining me to talk about it, the author of the study, Zlatan Krizon, is with us, assistant professor of psychology at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hello, Professor Krizon.
Hello. Good to be here.
Let's start with our foundation of making sure we understand what narcissism is and how it's different, say, from self-confidence.
That's an excellent question. It's also important to consider that when we speak about narcissism, we can speak about more extreme cases of what in the clinical area they call narcissistic personality disorder, and to distinguish that from a more sort of a normal range of expression of narcissism. So probably the most individuals we'll be talking about today are simply individuals who are relatively narcissistic without necessarily being disordered. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. As to your question about what is narcissism, there is a pretty much consensus that self-absorption, arrogance, and entitlement are key qualities of narcissism. So these are interrelated traits, that tend to co-occur in individuals we think of narcissistic. So this means that you believe you're special, that you deserve more than others, that others are really there to serve your own purposes.
Mm-hmm. And yet we define that differently than self-confidence. They seem to be together, but we teach our children to be self-confident. We want ourselves to be self-confident. What is the difference?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that often comes up actually as an issue in this research as well as broader discussions. So self-confidence is important and is healthy. We need to be able to express our views, to assert our wishes in socially appropriate ways, to communicate with other people about things that are important to us. But when this goes so far as to, for example, ignore social norms, rules of appropriate behavior, then we start to speak about more narcissistic behavior. So it's really an excess of self-confidence or a disturbance in self-confidence.
Mm-hmm. So it's really a continuum, what I hear you saying.
Absolutely.
A continuum, people who are very little narcissism and then more and more and more, and all of a sudden you get to a personality disorder. Your research defines two types of narcissism, I understand, grandiose and vulnerable. Tell us about those two.
Sure. And this is a distinction that has been made before, and as a matter of fact, it goes a long way back in this research area. I want to say that it's important to consider that these are not two distinct types. As a matter of fact, these are two sets of qualities that tend to co-occur in a narcissistic individual, such as that while a narcissistic individual may be high on both of these qualities, they could be high on one but not on the other. So if you think about the concept of size, you can be a tall individual and be large, and you can be a heavy individual and be large. And even though both are associated with the concept of size, neither one is completely necessary. So same here. So part of narcissism, this one aspect is grandiose. So this is being very exhibitionistic, wanting to be the center of attention, being extremely confident and extrovert in putting yourself outward to seek admiration. That's the grandiose aspect. And the vulnerable aspect is when your entitled expectations fail, and thus you feel that you've been really sabotaged by others, that they haven't recognized your greatness. And these are two different aspects that are somewhat present together in narcissism, but both are quite distinct and are related with quite distinct social consequences.
Mm. As you describe them, I can see that you could get into a grandiose phase, and then something happens to blow up that picture you have of yourself, and you slip into the vulnerable aspect.
Some clinicians, as a matter of fact, have interpreted that way, but it also seems that some people are sort of chronically either grandiose or vulnerable, depending mm-hmm. on their lives and what the social environment affords them.
Okay, we've laid the foundation there. You've explained it. Now tell us about your specific research that has been brought out that looked at the relationship between narcissism and envy.
Yeah, so this is a topic that actually goes, again, way back into theorizing about narcissism. And as a matter of fact, feelings of envy are one of the diagnostic criteria for narcissistic personality disorders. So for all those reasons, this is a topic that's quite important in this area. There have been a variety of ideas about whether and why narcissism should be associated with envy. And the prevailing idea is that those individuals who are especially grandiose, so who value their abilities. So these are, again, components and aspects of narcissism related to grandiosity. The running idea has been that it's these grandiose individuals who should be very prone to envy, given that they really sort of feel this grandiosity will be threatened, or really the notion that they don't buy into their own sense of worth. That's been the prevailing view, and what we have shown across a series of studies that involve both surveys of students and community residents, as well as laboratory behavioral measurement. What we've shown is that really the vulnerability, that it's extremely, extremely potent predictor of envy, and that people who are grandiose perhaps even envy less, which in some way makes sense, because if you really buy into your own fantasy of being great, there's not going to be many other people to envy out there.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any public figures in mind that you could name where you could say they are definitely in this class of grandiose narcissism that is not fueled by envy?
I will always be reticent when giving these names, and as well as make clear that we're not talking about disordered individuals, but from my observations in terms of the kind of personality qualities that we associated with these personality constructs, I would have to say Donald Trump is probably a good example of a definitely grandiose person that intends to engage in a lot of haughty behavior, express a lot of self-confidence. And I think if you look at his speeches and his public comments, I think many a time he refers to definitely not being the person that envies others, but the one that's being envied by others.
And you certainly see he has marketed his outbursts of aggression.
Absolutely. And sometimes with these public figures, that actually becomes an issue, because it's not clear to what extent you're really sort of observing personality qualities as they are of an individual versus some kind of a public persona they're using in order either to to earn money or to drum up attention.
Even when we have an example like Donald Trump as perhaps a good personality of that that we can point to in as a public personality, we can even still say, I mean, you can't diagnose from afar. This may still fall short of what the definition of narcissistic personality disorder is.
Absolutely.
Where is the line then when you get into the disorder?
That's a great question. And I think in general we draw a line when certain aspects of personality really start to interfere with social and occupational functioning, right? So when you have an individual whose entitled expectations and whose haughty treatment and arrogance toward others really gets them into a spot where they have trouble with their intimate relationships, with their work, with their circle of friends, perhaps leading them to be extremely distressed or angry or perhaps even depressed, it's in those extreme cases that we can speak about disorder. So it's always that interference aspect that it's key to something being pathology.
So similar to alcoholism.
Absolutely.
Where so you would say if you can, I mean, there are functioning alcoholics, but if you say it gets in the way of your day, your life, your relationships, then you have a problem.
Yeah, and the same, I think, criteria can be used for a lot of addiction concepts that are being discussed, such as video game addiction. It's not just enough to play a lot of video games. The point is that you play so much as that really becomes a detriment to other aspects of your life.
In your research, your latest research, what myth are you breaking?
Well, this myth that if you are very grandiose and full of yourself, that down beneath you actually envy others a lot. And in our research, we seem to refute that pretty consistently across a lot of different forms of evidence. So, it seems that really the grandiose individuals really buy into their own fantasy. And it's these vulnerable aspects of narcissism. So individuals who still have these grandiose fantasies, they want to be great, yet they really sort of can't get over the hump. And thus they view all these other people as superior and as sort of potential threats and tend to envy them a lot and feel a lot of hostility and resentment toward these other people because, in a sense, they don't allow them to be great as they want to be.
Mm-hmm. We were talking with my producer beforehand, Sarah Bowden, about this, and we were thinking, you know, narcissism as a personality disorder is unique in that we make a lot of jokes about narcissism. We have shows like The Office. The boss, Michael, in The Office is a classic narcissist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've seen that show, but I wonder if your studies, your research is harder or different in the way you have to approach it or the way you talk with people because it is not recognized in the same way as schizophrenia or depression in a personality. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is a general, I think, issue with personality disorder, and there's very vigorous debates currently going on in psychological and psychiatric communities about how personality disorder should be conceptualized. And the view that I subscribe to that indeed seems to be suggested by most of empirical research, again, is the one of the continuum that you described, such as that when we speak about personality disorder, this is not really a qualitatively different category. We're speaking about individuals who have extreme standings of certain combinations of traits that tend to create a lot of either interpersonal difficulties or emotional difficulties or both for these individuals. And it's in that realm when you start to speak about personality disorders. So in some way, the classic kind of disease models that have been applied even to psychological disorders really don't fit very easily in this realm.
How do we treat narcissistic personality disorder?
Yeah, this is a challenge with all personality disorder because by definition, they are sort of grounded in individuals' personalities. So they will be resistant to change. They probably reflect enduring dynamics about these individuals. So usually the treatment is slow and difficult. And traditionally, it's oriented around self-insight and helping these individuals realize that either overly grandiose views, views of themselves, or these overly vulnerable views of themselves are not very accurate, and as well as trying to help them to establish more intimate, more functional relationships in their lives.
So if I understand you correctly, it's holding up a mirror to their personality and making them pointing out things in that mirror that they weren't aware of before?
Absolutely, and especially within a context of their functioning and relationships. So, again, and the modern approaches are pretty diverse and involve some of the traditional ideas as well as advancement that's been going on in cognitive behavioral therapy, etc. But it's definitely, in heavy cases which need treatment, which are sort of extreme cases by definition, the treatment is usually recognized as difficult. To give you a sort of a cute story that illustrates some of these difficulties, there's one account of a person in New York City who was seeking treatment for narcissism. And this person identified the most well-known, well-regarded psychiatrist in a city. And when he went and visited with the psychiatrist's office and learned that he can be treated there, he decided not to seek treatment anymore. Because, by golly, if he cannot be treated with the most famous, by the most famous psychiatrist in New York City, he's not going to be treated by anybody. So these are some of the issues, for example, that clinicians report in dealing with these individuals.
So in this kind of this kind of work, can you give me an example of a dialogue that you might have or a therapist might have with a narcissist?
So because I'm not a clinician and I don't do therapy, so most of my research does not involve protracted discussions with individuals. It's rather assessing their personality qualities and personality traits and then assessing other variables, for example, such as envy toward their peers or aggressive responses in laboratory paradigms of aggression. And usually, we'll administer a variety of questionnaires such as that the purpose is necessarily not going to be obvious. We don't ask people if they are narcissistic or view themselves as narcissists. We rather ask them a lot of questions about their personalities, about their tendencies to behave, act, think and feel in particular ways. And from that, based on a sort of knowledge we have from prior studies and this validated questionnaire, we can extract information about where they stand on this continuum regarding narcissistic grandiosity and vulnerability.
Are there a handful of questions that our listeners can ask themselves to find out if they have a narcissist in their life?
There are definitely those questions. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of sort of popular books that try to teach you, whether you're living with a narcissist and what you should do. If you are, I think, again, to what extent the individual that you're interacting with behaves according to ways to either buttress their self-view, to protect their sense of self-esteem, the way they express themselves, anger or surprise by not being treated very positively or admired by others, by viewing themselves being sabotaged by others, not recognizing their value and worth. So in general, those are the kinds of things one needs to look for. But again, the specific presentation could quite vary. And I just want to add one more thing to that makes this difficult is, when we think about this grandiosity and vulnerability, the life circumstances can put a really different spin on this disturbance. So some people have, for example, invoked the concept of acquired social narcissism, meaning that if you're in a life position where you are of high status, you're very well off, you are very well admired, you do have capabilities and abilities. So in a sense, there are reasons for you to be valued and admired by others. You know, over time, you can develop this sort of cult of personality and a sense of yourself, as somebody says, more important to others. I mean, think about some of these actors and stars who are constantly surrounded by yes men and by people catering to them and complimenting them. And, you know, they can do no wrong. I mean, after living in such an environment, especially if you have some of these narcissistic tendencies, you may develop a lot of narcissistic qualities, but they may not have a lot of interference to the extent, for example, you're rich, you have a lot of money, And you can basically accomplish the thing that you want to without a lot of interference from others.
Mm-hmm. Talk more about what you think creates narcissism, more of the upbringing, or are we born with this quality?
This is a million-dollar question always, and historically the answers are focused on parent-child interactions, for example, having cold and indifferent parents. There's not a lot of empirical research on this for a lot of reasons. One of them is that, you know, ideally we'd want long-term longitudinal studies where we follow people from childhood all the way into adulthood, and those are very rare and expensive. But I think we need to consider narcissism in a context of broader personality differences as well as the social environments that people function in. And so we know that certain aspects of personality are key to these grandiose and vulnerable expressions of narcissism. So being very ebullient and extroverted and dominant is key to grandiosity. And we know that this extroversion and dominance is a heritable trait. We know this is something that's partially reflected in temperament, even in newborns. So I think there are these more broader aspects underlying narcissism, which are certainly genetic, partially inherited, and shaped by early infant interactions. But I think we still don't have a good understanding of that sort of magic step or those very important events that may be happening in early childhood or young adolescence, which seem to create this differences in narcissism that can already be seen in high school age kids.
We have about a minute left. I wonder if you could give us a forecast of where you're going in your research with narcissism.
So in ongoing research, we're really focusing on this link between narcissism and aggression, and this is something that comes up very often in public discussion, especially recently with the cases of Christopher Dorner, the police officer in L.A. And in this work, too, we are seeing as the narcissistic vulnerability almost being a bigger problem for aggression. And again, these are not individuals that we may notice at the outset as being narcissistic or consider narcissistic, because they're not likely to be very exhibitionistic. They're maybe festering there in the corner, wondering why other people are not recognizing their greatness. And when that push comes to shove, they seem to react aggressively. And indeed, this seems to be a theme that, at least on the surface, fits a lot of these events that we've been seeing recently.
Mm-hmm. And so specifically, how will you attack those questions?
So what we do...
We only have 30 seconds, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do, for example, laboratory experiments in which we involve people in particular behaviors which they think serve one purpose and in reality serve to assess aggression. So in this way, we can sort of get more pure a sense of their aggression without them getting in the way of their own natural behavior.
Okay, Zlatan Krizon, thank you very much. Assistant Professor of Psychology at Iowa State University.
Thank you
for coming to our studio today.
You too. Have a good day.
Okay, you too.
Today, you are listening to an archive edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions. Contact us anytime at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Coming up in the second half, doctors at the University of Iowa discuss how the human brain is divided when it comes to fear and panic, and how this discovery could be used to treat panic attacks, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and other anxiety-related conditions. That's in a few minutes after the news.
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program.
And finally today, new research on the feelings you might have just sensed upon hearing this music from Psycho. Fear and panic, where fear and panic originates in our brains, and how our brains might treat them differently than we previously understood. Joining me now, Dr. John Wemmy, a neuroscientist and associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and the Veterans Administration Hospital in our Iowa City studio, along with Colin Buzza, a medical student at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Wemmy, you published this paper in the journal Nature Neuroscience, showing that the amygdala, we'll talk about that in a minute, a part of the brain, is not the only gatekeeper of fear in the human mind. Colin Buzza, you were a contributing author to the paper. A new study showing that different areas of the brain are responsible for different, for external versus internal threats. Let's boil that down in a minute, what you actually found out. But because the amygdala, part of our brain, is so central to our discussion, let's start there and tell us, what is the amygdala? Where is it located? What does it look like? What does it do?
Okay, so the amygdala is a small part of the brain. It's about the size of a thumb, the tip of your thumb. And we have two copies of an amygdala on each side of our brain. It's buried deep in the temporal lobe. Those are sort of the two arms that come out on the side of the brain that you see sometimes in pictures. And this structure, there's an awful lot of work in animals and humans and decades of research suggesting this structure is really, really critical for sensing or detecting or experiencing fear.
Experiencing fear of all types, going back to ancestors, fear of a wild animal, fear of an attack on your tribe.
That's a really good point. I think it's even goes farther back than that evolutionarily because, animals have very similar conservation in this structure from species to species. And its role seems to be very well conserved between species. So I think this is a very evolutionarily ancient structure that it's really critical for survival.
Not only mammals, but all other species as well have this same amygdala.
Not only mammals, is that what you said?
Yeah.
It's interesting to ask, is there something equivalent in a fly or a worm? And I think because the architecture of those organisms is so different, hard to make that speculation.
Okay. We're getting off the track anyway. So let's talk a little bit about this experiment. And I understand with this experiment, you had some people participate who don't experience fear due to a damage to their amygdala. What sort of damage?
Colin, you want to take that one?
Yeah, so each of the three subjects that we tested has a damage to their amygdala on both sides due to a rare genetic condition called Urbach-Vitae disease. And so this is a disease that causes, it's a mutation in an extracellular matrix protein that has mostly effects on the skin, but for unknown reasons, it also causes destruction of that specific brain region, the amygdala, that's fairly selective for that region.
The effect being that these people have no sense of fear or?
Well, other researchers, largely here at the University of Iowa, have done a lot of work on studying this question. A lot of what we know about the amygdala in humans comes from research on one particular patient who's known as patient SM and who has this damage to her amygdala.
And a patient that you know and have
that participated in our study.
Mm-hmm. So take us to this study, the basis of the new findings that are announced in this Nature Neuroscience article. What was the experiment that you did with these people who had damaged amygdala?
Right. So, as we mentioned, people have had a lot of clues suggesting the amygdala is critical for fear and maybe panic. And there is a technique that's been used in psychiatric research to evoke panic attacks in people who are especially sensitive to panic attacks, like those with panic disorder. And this is inhalation of carbon dioxide, a single breath, deep inhalation of carbon dioxide. And most people who have panic disorder will have a panic attack if they inhale carbon dioxide.
Okay, this is of course deadly at a longer period. But
yeah, at high, very high concentrations.
So you put some in a chamber and subject them to CO2?
Actually, you put a mask on, and they take one very deep breath of CO2, and then we examine the effects of that.
Okay. What happens to a person without damaged amygdala? What would happen to me if I put this mask on and got that?
I mean, odds are if you were to do it, you would probably experience some feelings of anxiety, but mostly you would have a strong respiratory drive and a feeling of air hunger.
I would immediately panic?
You probably would not panic unless you had panic disorder or a family history of panic disorder.
Okay.
But about 1 in 10 people who has no family history or no personal history will have a panic attack as well.
Okay. Now we take our subjects who have damaged amygdala and we compare their reaction to this. How do they react?
That's right. That's right. So we went into this with the hypothesis that they would be insensitive to this stimulus because so many other studies have suggested that they lack fear. And so the first subject came in, first patient came in, went through this protocol, took the CO2 inhalation, and immediately had a panic attack. And we were stunned because we were really expecting the opposite outcome.
Mm-hmm. That because they had this damaged amygdala, they would not register fear because they had, as we understood prior to this, no sort of fear indicator there too. So that happened the first time. Did that happen with other similar subjects?
We had three subjects that have similar damage, and it happened to all three of them, and it happened more than once to all three.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So now what we thought was true is no longer true. What do you think happened? What's going on? What have we misunderstood?
So, yeah, it's really interesting. To answer your question, what did we not know that we now know? That's going to take some time, and we have to think about that.
what could you surmise?
What it suggests at the very fundamental level is although the amygdala plays an important role in fear, it's not absolutely required for a panic attack. And even more than that, because there was a higher rate of these panic attacks in these special patients, it suggests maybe the amygdala has some role in inhibiting panic attacks. And that's sort of a new concept to consider. This area that has been thought to be really important in fear might actually play a role negatively regulating panic attacks, mm-hmm. which then, of course, suggests that maybe panic disorder, some similar sort of dysfunction could be potentially contributing to panic disorder. And that's where a new line of research begins.
I wonder if it says anything about the nature of fear. Fear is not fear, or panic is not panic. We might learn to fear something because we might learn to fear dogs because we had a bad experience as a boy. So every time I would run into a dog after having a bad experience, I experienced fear. But initially, I did not have that. Now, the people with damaged amygdala with this syndrome, that opposed to a different type of fear where you're saying the CO2 in the air, where your body senses something organically, physically is not right. Those are two different types, right? Am I not using the right terminology?
Yeah, no, I think you're right on. We have others actually have been studying SM for years and patients like her, and all of these things that have failed to evoke fear-like responses have seemed to have been these extraceptive types of stimuli, things that rely on your vision or
things that we need to interpret. We need to
sense from the outside.
We need to recognize that is a spider, that is a snake, that is a wolf with fangs.
Things on the out, threats from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that may be different in considering, you know, what is it about this that's unique relative to these other kinds of stimuli is it is acting internally. Mm. We inhale it. It's a gas. It acts like, maybe a drug. And our ability to sense that as a threat, I think that this work is suggesting possibly those kinds of threats evoke fear through different mechanisms through different pathways.
It's interesting. We're talking with Dr. John Wemmy, a neuroscientist, associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and the Veterans Administration Hospital in Iowa City, also with Colin Buzza. They've put out a paper in the journal Nature Neuroscience talking about how fear, panic is sort of cordoned off in our mind, trying to figure out what we understood about it and what this experiment that they've been describing changes in our understanding of that. This is interesting. You have these test subjects, SM or MS?
SM.
SM. And so when this person was, as a subject, put on the mask and had a certain level of high levels of CO2 making them feel fear, they were previously people who had not felt fear when they saw, you know, from heights or snakes or Jack Nicholson in The Shining. They would not have felt fear. So was this perhaps the first time they felt fear?
Yeah, that's the implication. So we're trying to put ourselves in her shoes and experience what she's experienced without an amygdala and try to imagine what that's like. And this was the first time experimentally or in her life where she has expressed this kind of emotion.
Mm-hmm. What were her words? What did she say?
Well, she said... She described it as fear, and she described it as panic.
Actually, if you remember, her first word was help.
Yeah.
Help.
Yeah.
One syllable.
Yeah.
Help.
Help me. That's what she said.
I wonder if you interviewed her, if she related it to anything else she'd felt in life.
There was nothing comparable for any of these subjects. They had all said that the feeling that they experienced was completely novel.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go from here with this knowledge? It sounds like this is an experiment that certainly surprised you, surprised the scientific community. Am I right? What is the reaction of the scientific community to this finding?
Yeah, I think there has been some surprise. I think it will shape how people think about the fear system and how it's probably a lot more complicated than being just a monolithic structure that's involved. And a number of researchers have sort of written about this and suspected it. But in humans, I think this may be one of the first clearest examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Go back and now say, with these findings, what will be done with these findings? What is the way you parse it into a new experiment or experiments to answer new questions based on these findings?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're asking it ourselves all the time. And so there are some important questions that follow. What brain structures do mediate this response? Does the amygdala really inhibit them? Can we demonstrate that more clearly? Can we find ways to do that? How is this actually related to panic disorder? Is this a key causative mechanism in panic disorder? And those are several important questions that we want to try to get at in the future.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, going back to your test subject, SM, or the other ones who had this disorder, mm-hmm. damaged amygdala, not feeling fear, to put it broadly. How does a person like that operate in life different than we do? Because fears are very useful things, aren't they?
That's a great question. And Colin, you and I were just talking about this yesterday. What do you think?
I mean, you know, it's interesting. These people, they have a normal intelligence. You know, they feel most of the same emotions we would otherwise feel. But it seems to be that they can intellectually learn about, so to avoid certain things. And if you ask them for advice on what are things that you should avoid and what are things that you could do, they would probably give you pretty good advice.
Probably to help people understand, I think, what we imagine this to be like is lacking that sort of gut feeling that you feel when you're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the conscious knowledge of knowing that something could be dangerous. It's just that little voice that says, you know, beware.
Right. So, okay, you know. I'll go hike at Palisades Kepler here in Iowa, and I go up on that trail, and there's a cliff that would do me in if I fell over the cliff. So the person with this damage to their amygdala is approaching that cliff, and I get close to it, and I start feeling what you just described, Dr. Wemmy, right?
That's right.
I feel, it's a horrible feeling, and it ushers me away from that. That other person, SM, does what in that situation?
It seems like all three of these patients sort of lack that internal arousal sensation that you know, they realize that the cliff is dangerous and that they could fall off it, but they just don't have that gut feeling that causes them mm-hmm. to be terrified of.
So they're, on the other hand, thinking, just intellectually, I go to the cliff, I go fall off the cliff, I die, without any feelings attached.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right, Colin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without being sort of imbued with that, the emotional side of what most people would have in that situation.
I guess these people would, a whole genre of film, horror, would be wasted on that.
And researchers at the University of Iowa, like Justin Feinstein, who was a co-first author on this paper, has actually taken SM2 scary movies and to see what her response is like. And they haven't been able to scare her with those types of stimuli.
Nothing. Wow. Okay. I could come up with a short list very quickly.
Haunted houses, tarantulas, boa constrictors, all those things.
Dr. Wemmy, you work at the Veterans Administration Hospital with patients who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Let's talk a little bit about that. We've got a few minutes left. Remind us what that is, because we're
post-traumatic stress disorder is an illness that occurs when someone has suffered a life-threatening threat or trauma, and the memory of this starts to permeate their future lives and interferes with their lives, disrupting their daily activities and their sleep and their relationships. And so this awful memory keeps intruding in their lives. And I think that's the essence of what we see with post-traumatic stress disorder.
And we hear it most in connection with our returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, but also from firefighters and first responders who come upon horrific events.
Car wrecks. And essentially anybody who has suffered a life-threatening trauma is potentially vulnerable to this problem.
Okay. Now, what are you doing in terms of research there for treatment of PTSD? Where have we made strides in the past few years?
So at the core, this is sort of a fear memory. And so thinking about fear and how it's recalled, and actually the role of the amygdala in this process has really dominated a lot of thinking about the neurobiological mechanisms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so I think that's one of the driving factors in our research, is trying to understand the amygdala and how it's influenced and what role it plays. And a lot of that is because of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm. So have we learned anything that will help people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder recently that will help them?
You know, even our paper that we just published that we're talking about today is interesting, because these patients who were very vulnerable to carbon dioxide inhalation and had a panic attack, first time in their lives, and they admitted they felt afraid and panicked, but, you know, they were willing to do it again, and it didn't disrupt their thinking. And they had no problems trying this out again. So I think that also is telling us something about the amygdala.
And it's telling us something about the nature of fear, isn't it, Colin? Because we mentioned the horror film genre. We don't like being afraid, but then we do. We have a love-hate relationship with roller coasters, with the films that scare us.
Sure, and we wondered about that too, if there was a bit of that sort of novelty aspect that was driving them to be willing to do it again. But it actually seemed to be that they just didn't have sort of the emotional significance of what had happened to them. They didn't seem to carry that forward with them after the experiment.
What do you mean by that?
So sort of if they thought back on, I mean, if you had a frightening experience and you thought back on it, you know, you might have, your heart might start racing, you might start breathing a little faster, you might start, your
sweating.
Palms might sweat, and they could describe what had happened to them, but they wouldn't have that sort of reaction.
There wouldn't be a mini internal reenactment.
Correct.
In their body. They wouldn't sort of play that loop again and again that, unfortunately, people who'd experience traumatic events do replay again and again and can't get rid of it. And that's the essence of treating post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, that's right. So, which makes our work interesting to think about. On one hand, these cases lack a certain element of fear. On the other hand, they're especially vulnerable to it. So we've got our work cut out for us to figure out how there's this dual role being played by the amygdala.
Okay. What do you have on the immediate horizon that you want to look at? Colin, tell us, since you're a medical student, or either of you. We've got a few seconds.
Well, we've got opportunities to study this in humans who have brain lesions elsewhere, and we do an awful lot of research studying animals and mice, mm-hmm. and we can make genetic manipulations in mice, and we have a lot more power to investigate this in animal models like mice. And so I think for the next few years, a lot of our work is going to be trying to figure this out in animals.
Dr. John Wemmy, Colin Buzza, Dr. Wemmy, you described your work as interesting. I'm going to up that to incredibly fascinating, if you don't mind.
That's great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for coming in. Dr. John Wemmy, a neuroscientist and associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and the Veterans Administration Hospital. Colin Buzza, a medical student at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. If you caught part of the program, you want to hear the whole thing, we always podcast these programs. Put them on our on our website forever, actually. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.